Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And then he said, no one gets what they deserve. You get what you earn. And so that really was super instrumental in me just thinking, like, I mean, there's nothing that's going to be given. I'm going to have to go out and get it no matter what happens. Like, doesn't matter what I did the day before. I got to go earn it the next day.
Why did I become an executive coach? I saw lots of great people fail to get ahead at work, while their much less talented peers blew right past them. That made me furious, but also curious. What were great people getting wrong? It came down to helping them re-examine what drove success and then helping them make critical shifts, one hard truth at a time.
Feel like you're doing everything you were told, but you're not moving ahead at work nor having the impact you seek? Then welcome to 97% Effective with Michael Winderoth, where we skip feel-good, happy talk and engage experts in pointed conversations about what it really takes to move the needle at work and your career. So if you feel stalled or frustrated, or seek that extra edge as you move to the next level, then look no further. This is the Hard Truths Playbook you never got.
Hi, I'm Michael Winderoth, and you're listening to 97% Effective. From a very young age, my guest today wanted to be a manager, because that came with power. But he had a very specific reason, which we're going to discuss, about how he wanted to use that power. As he rose through the world of college football, the Air Force Academy, working in national defense at Stanford Business School, and into the upper echelons of the finance world, he's shown he not only makes the most of opportunities, but creates them. He's also shown how to strategically and thoughtfully build a network that has helped him, but more importantly, also helped others and his larger causes. Yes, networking does not have to be a selfish endeavor. My guest today is David Harris. Very excited to have him here. He is a software investor at Vista Equity Partners, a position he landed after graduating from the Stanford Graduate School of Business in 2024. David is also a proud graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, where he played on the Division I football team and served as squadron commander. After graduating from the Air Force, David served in the U.S. National Reconnaissance Office, managing a $250 million software development portfolio, and as a program manager in supporting the development of the Department of Defense's nuclear cruise missile. His first role in finance was as a summer analyst at Pharos Capital. We're going to dig back into that. And later included serving as summer associate at Blackstone in the Tactical Opportunities Group. David is a member of the Milken Institute Young Leader Circle, mentor of Management Leadership for Tomorrow, MLT, originally from Dallas, Texas, an avid Cowboys fan. While there have been some great interviews with David prior to his Stanford MBA, I'm excited to be the first, I believe, to talk with him about his new role here post-MBA as investor at Vista Equity Partners. That is a top-tier firm, if you're not familiar with them, in the private equity world, with over $100 billion in assets under management. Really want to discuss what has propelled his meteoric rise. And personally, I got to know David as he was finishing his MBA at Stanford, also where I did my MBA. His ability to connect and ability to connect immediately really impressed me. And the more we spoke, the more I wanted others, particularly those in the audience, to hear his story and insights. David, welcome to 97% Effective.
Oh, thanks, Michael. I mean, this is truly an honor. I'm excited to join, you know, for the conversation today, just knowing how impactful you've been to so many others, and also very appreciative to be in the same breath of the previous guest, so, which is extremely high bar. So we're really excited to be on. And yes, this is the first interview post-B-School, and even more excited.
Awesome. Very privileged to have you. And I'm going to start on a little bit of a tough note, right? You know, we live in times of and an atmosphere, particularly in the States, incredible divisiveness, contention. And right off the bat, I saw you and I have an incredibly deep divide in our backgrounds. One might say like our DNA, maybe our religion, that would make us mortal enemies. You were born a Cowboys fan. I am a diehard from Philadelphia, grew up Eagles fan. You know, so we're not shouting at each other or dismissing each other. I just thought, could we be constructive here? And maybe you could share one complimentary thing about the Philadelphia Eagles.
That's let me think about that one. The thing I think one good thing I did see, y'all looked incredible in that loss a few weeks ago. That's probably the best I can say.
It's been a rocky start, I think, for both teams this season.
No, absolutely. We're not doing too much better.
But I will come back and also say that I know who I'm rooting for when they play each other. That's been pretty clear since day one for me. But if you look at my past fantasy football teams, I have definitely had a fair amount of Cowboys on there, and that's for a reason.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. No, they've been really good. I will say one good thing about the Eagles also is they are incredible at drafting. I think they know what to do, which is a problem in the NFC East because y'all are so good at drafting. And they also drafted a lot of players I played against, so which was really great. Pro Bowl, the last one was the Jay Ajayi, a Pro Bowl running back. So yeah, they do a great job with that.
Yeah, and David, you played at the Air Force. What position did you play?
I was a D lineman. A lot of pounds, a lot of ligaments ago.
Okay. Well, you certainly bring that to everything you do. A lot of energy and force. And we talked about power here at the beginning. Go back to the thing I said at the very outset of the show, because I've heard this story that at age 6, at a family get together, you told the rest of the family that you wanted to grow up and be a manager. Share a little bit more about that and why you said that.
That's 100% true. Kind of set the stage a little bit back then. So, I mean, this is the late 90s. A lot of, you know, division in the country just based on, you know, racial tension. And so we have this thing that I call, when we were younger, called ear hustling. And so when I was younger, I would listen to, you know, bits and pieces of conversation I shouldn't have been. And I would find out just information about my family. Like, hey, you know, there's, you know, harassment in the workplace, some discrimination in the workplace. And, you know, there's money issues. Like, I don't know if I can pay my bill, you know, and I'm just overhearing these things. And, you know, and I'm looking at my mother, who was kind of our, you know, a stalwart in our family, who was the first generation college graduate. You know, she became an elementary school teacher to help build up the next generation. So, you know, I saw that too. And I was like, well, you know, I probably, you know, I should do my part to help out the family. And, you know, my limited vocabulary. And it's funny, we're at a family function and all the kids got lined up and we went down the line saying, hey, who do you want to be when you grow up? You know, people were, you know, doctor, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be, you know, a teacher like my mother. And, you know, and it's coming to me, it's my turn. And I'm, you know, I'm expected to give a very studious answer. And I shout out, I want to be a manager. And when I tell you, it got completely silent. It was, you hear a pin drop. And it was only broken by my uncle's most boisterous laugh you've ever heard. And so he died laughing. And so then everyone started whispering. And he then asked me, says, David, you know, what type, you know, where do you want to be a manager at? And in my mind, you know, the only place I could really think of is I want to be a manager at McDonald's. And so now my mother's, you know, she's like, you know, she's, you know, wide-eyed. And she walks over as the, you know, patient teacher and incredible mother she is. She asks, like, you know, what do you mean by that? And so my thought process was, you know, if I'm a manager and if I'm in charge, you know, there wouldn't be any harassment. There wouldn't be discrimination in the workplace. You know, I can take care of my family and no one would have to go through these hardships that they're going through now. And so that's originally where it came from. And I think that has led me to a lot of places, you know, that I've gone and kind of keeping that same thread, wanting to be a manager. It was funny because my mom, you know, she smiled and was like, you know, good job. And she went and punched my uncle in the, you know, in the shoulder. And we still laugh about that to this day.
You've also said a lot, and I know this has come up in our conversations, that you're really about serving. Mm-hmm. And you've used that word a lot. Is that what drew you to the Air Force?
Yeah, it actually was football recruiting. I mean, it was college football recruiting. Academics were ingrained in me from a young age. I was like, hey, I want to go to the place where I can get, you know, the best academic experience, but also, you know, the best collegiate football experience. And funny enough, you'll love this. You know, I narrowed it down to the three service academies, and you guessed it, in Stanford. And they were recruiting me pretty heavily. But then, you know, all the top recruits, all the D linemen in my position committed, and they didn't need me anymore. And they definitely made the right decision, as those people, those D linemen are Pro Bowlers still today. And so then it was down to a few service academies, and ultimately ended up choosing the Air Force Academy. Just, you know, felt like home. There's something that, you know, that very true that, you know, we, you know, saying we stay at the academy, the reason that you go to the academy is not the reason you stay. And so effectively that means once you get there, you then learn, you know, a completely different side of service. You know, you learn the commitment to something bigger than yourself. And so that was very true to me. Towards the end, I was very excited to go, you know, to go serve and go be a part of something bigger than myself and, you know, and protect everything that I hold dear. It was a great, great experience. Mm.
Podcast is around career acceleration, influence, and power. We're going to talk about seizing, creating opportunities, and networking, which I think you do incredibly well. You move to the finance world. Before we dive into the things that you did, let's take half a step back, because as soon as you bring up investing, it raises a lot of eyebrows for a large segment of the population out there. Especially private equity, right? It's kind of viewed as you come in and slash and burn, not necessarily serving, it's caking. So I'd just like to get your perspectives on how you see finance and investing match and mesh with your vision of serving. Because I think this is a very important point.
To be completely honest, I mean, a lot of those things are true. There are some investment strategies where that's the main way to generate return on investment. But from my experience, there's two main things that really drive me. The first one was my first internship at Pharos. My second week, we have a Monday morning meeting, as all firms do, and they're going through their recent investments they closed, they've been working on, you know, a few months prior. And they were giving some of the stats where they were creating, this is a healthcare investment firm, where they were rolling up oncology practices. And so one of the things that they were very proud of is that because they rolled it up, they were able to provide access to care to thousands of people in the Midwest. I was like, hey, you actually can create impactful investments through private equity, through better management, through better partnerships. And so like that really was when the light bulb went off, like, hey, we really can have tangible impact in people's lives. And then the second piece is the tertiary effects of private equity, where the money, you know, originates from. And so a lot of private equity funds, or the larger ones, they raise funds through pension funds. So think about the firefighters' pension funds, police pension funds, and, you know, ironically enough, teachers' pension funds. And so as a result, at Vista Equity Partners, who is based in Texas, we manage the Texas Teachers Retirement Fund. So in a very serendipitous circle, I'm effectively managing a piece of my mother's retirement. And so for me, that gives me great pride when, you know, going in and investing to ensure that, you know, she gets a few more dips on her retirement, which she always lets me know.
David, first of all, I also just want to call out, thank you for very succinctly breaking down what private equity is. I know a lot of people out there may not be familiar with it. And I think this is actually something we have in common, because I think I listened to one of your podcasts when you first got to the Air Force Academy. You had no idea what some of the roles in the finance world, right, were. And that was the same for me. That was going to Stanford at business school. I was like, what is venture capital? I have no idea. I was before that out in China setting up hospitals. So very nice, succinct breakdown of what you guys do and where the money comes from and how you deploy it. So you have this light bulb that goes off when you're at the Air Force Academy that turns you on to finance and investing. Now, it's one thing to kind of just be interested in it. It's the other thing to then land not only at Pharos, but then we're going to talk about Blackstone. Then we're going to talk about, you know, currently at Vista. Let's go back to like how you made that internship. It was only 60 days, right? But it was a very intense and important time that kind of kicked things off for you. Say more about how you landed that, because it's not intuitive, right, that you'll go directly to a place like that.
In my second semester senior year, I knew longer term that, you know, investing was probably going to be something that was going to, you know, pull me away from the military, pull me away from service from a long-term perspective. And so I read a book about investment banking, but what actually, you know, what do you actually do? Like, what's the difference between investment banking and private equity day to day? And so what I did is I made probably the worst LinkedIn profile probably anyone's ever seen. You know, put all the stuff on there. I mean, I'm a senior in college, so I don't have much to put on there. And just started seeing like, hey, can I find someone who has a similar background to me, who's gone through similar things and understand like, hey, why did this draw you to it? And And interesting enough, I found, you know, one of my biggest, you know, biggest supporters and mentors to this day, Christian Evans. And when I say he was a, you know, photocopy, basically where I wanted to be in 10 years. I mean, it was incredible. He was from Texas, played football, was a Black Air Force officer, and then was an investment banker at Goldman at the time. I mean, so this is literally the, and was also in a nonprofit I was in. I mean, this is literally the exact person that I should be talking to. And so this is like my first cold message that I've sent. And I sent, you know, probably one of the worst ones also. And I sent him a message and he, you know, he agreed to the meetup. But I would say a piece of that too is, you know, I think part of the reason why he even responded is one of my teachers was actually one of his class, or my professors were actually one of his classmates. And so knowing that, I like asked him, like, hey, is there something funny anecdote about him? And, you know, they had something funny and I threw that in the message and he enjoyed that. He said, how did I find that out? But, you know, that, I think that was another reason why he initially spoke to me. But during the conversation, I will say the thing that really got me over the hump there is, you know, I just came in with this mindset of just being humble and hungry. That was the thing I wanted to get across to him and just let him understand. And another thing we still laugh at to this day is, you know, I had no idea what Goldman Sachs meant. I didn't know exactly. I just heard of it. And I was like, hey, it's probably a nice place to work. And I asked him, you know, very pointedly, I was like, hey, unabashedly, I said, you know, is there any way, like, can you give me an internship at Goldman? And this is in January. And I'm asking, I get an internship at the end of May. And he laughed. And I said, I appreciate you, you know, the hustle. But I don't think I can get you an internship at Goldman. I mean, Goldman is one of the, you know, premier institutions in the world, not even finance. And they give out those internships years in advance. And so for me to be asking for an internship, you know, a few months in advance is pretty funny. But I think for him, that kind of showed, you know, the hunger that I had. And he was, you know, more receptive to help me. And sure enough, he was like, hey, I can't get you an internship at Goldman, but let me reach out to a few of my mentors and we'll see what I can do. And so then that led to him introducing me to, you know, once again, one of probably another big piece of serendipity, to Neil Youngblood. And these are the first people I'm reaching out to. This isn't like over a protracted period. Like Christian Evans was the first person I reached out to. And then from there, he connected me with Neil Youngblood, who was the chairman and founder of Pharos Capital. And so that was even more, you know, that was even harder because Neil, his nickname is the most interesting man in the world, but which you can do a whole nother podcast on that. But you know, the thing is, there was nothing online about him. Like he was very intentional about not having an online presence back then. And so I had to literally look, I had to go find out what boards he was on, seeing, you know, what institutions were a part of, and then find people that I was, you know, tangentially connected to just so I can get some information about Neil. And so that was another thing that, you know, I was like, hey, I want to make a good impression, you know, that I don't take this opportunity to speak with him lightly. And so I found out, you know, just a funny anecdote of how he got into private equity. And so then, you know, within the first 5 minutes, I was like, hey, you know, I think our reasonings to getting into, you know, finance are very similar. And I think he resonated with that as well. I asked him too. I was like, hey, why did you, you know, what made you help me out? You know, I was a person that was going into the military for 5 years. You know, you're one of the top firms in Dallas. Why did you, you know, open up a seat for me to sit in the summer knowing I wasn't going to come back or, you know, may not ever go into finance? And he just said, and he forbade him. Kind of told me, it's like, you know, you were humble and hungry. And through those, you know, and so then I flew down. He said, hey, you know, like meeting you, fly down during your spring break, which I was surprised he asked me to do, and then interview. And so I flew down to Dallas and then interviewed and was fortunate enough to return later on that summer. So it was, you know, it was an incredible, incredible experience.
Humble and hungry. There's so much that's embodied in how you approached it and the things you did. What are some of the keys in that initial networking that you feel are like really important?
Yeah, I think you need to do sort of, you know, the secondary and tertiary research. I think everyone kind of gets like, hey, LinkedIn, let me see, you know, we went to the, you know, same alma mater, or maybe we did the same clubs, we played the same sport in undergrad. But then I think you have to take steps, lower, deeper than that, to really make a good first impression, because that's the thing. You want to be memorable to these people who, you know, get these requests all the time, every day. And so that was my thing. If I'm just memorable, you know, maybe like that'll just plant a seed that, you know, then I could help grow. And so that was the thing. It was like, my thing was like, I got to find out something that they would just be so surprised that I knew. Just this is a random, you know, guy from the Air Force Academy. Like, why would he know about, you know, why I got into private equity? And why would he know about something that happened 10 years before he even got to the academy, you know, with relation to Christian? So that was like the thing that I stumbled upon. I was like, hey, let me just try to make myself memorable. And I think, and that just goes to the humility piece of it, just taking the extra effort to really dive deep and to find something that would make it even special. And so that led me to, like, once you do that initial LinkedIn search, now you're going to see what boards are they on? Like, what professional relationships do they have? What, you know, personal things they have, what the nonprofits they support. Let's see, like, oh, let's find who's on that board. Let's see who, you know, they have similar interests. Okay, now I'm going to talk to them as well. And then once you get on the phone with them, then it's a, hey, nice, you know, you introduce yourself, you have the conversation. Now it's a, hey, I'm meeting with so-and-so, you know, next week. Was just curious, did you have any, you know, funny anecdotes on the person? But also, can you just give them a heads up that, you know, that I spoke to you? And once you start doing that, you know, a few times, then it becomes a triangulating on people. And then they're like, oh, wow, this, how did they already speak to, you know, my peer at another firm? And I was like, well, now I need to hire him before, you know, the next firm gets him. And so I will say I stumbled into it and realized, you know, that strategy worked out, and then just kind of kept going. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, massive research, right? Like what you said with the second and third, the warm intros and being ultra prepared.
You've been listening to 97% Effective with your host, executive coach, Michael Winderoth. If this interview is making you think, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, back to our interview.
I do want to ask, because you did seem to hit it out of the park, right? You said as you found someone in Christian there. I do recall you saying too, like on some of your networking, you really also worked it. In fact, at one point, like LinkedIn said, you're reaching out to too many people and they were going to shut you down.
Yeah. But
that anecdote seemed really struck me because it's the hungry part of the humble and hungry. What happened there, or what was the learning here?
LinkedIn jail. Like if you send out too many messages or you search too many people and like within a certain time period in a day, they will lock you out for 12 hours. And like most people even know that's a thing. But it's like, and I like to tell people, you just got to flood the market. Like as many people has to hear your story as possible. And I kind of took that to heart very early on and was just trying to find anyone with any connection that I can kind of, you know, build, you know, a network to help pivot, you know, the finance industry. So yeah, that LinkedIn jail was not fun.
So this is all about creating those opportunities. And I understand when you graduate from the Air Force, before you then go and serve, you have this kind of 60-day window. Mm-hmm. And most people will take time off, right? A breather. That's where you did your internship.
Yeah. You know, for better or for worse. I mean, it was, so the thing is actually, during those 60 days, most of the graduates go to what's called Yacht Week. And so I was seeing pictures of, you know, people on yachts and they're having fun. And after these grueling, you know, 4 years at the academy, and I'm sitting there, you know, on Excel, you know, at 8 p.m. And I'm like, wow, did I make the right decision? But I mean, no, it was, you know, it was, and I probably had about as much fun as I would have had, you know, weird as it sounds, you know, going to Yacht Week. It was just so informative to what I really wanted to do. I've never been exposed to anything like that in my life. I've never been exposed to someone like Nealon, who I try to just emulate 1% of. And so I just learned so much about myself and what I wanted to do that, you know, it was about as fun as I, you know, probably could have had during those 60 days. But yeah, most people, you know, take the time off.
Yeah. So during those 60 days, David, you're a sponge. You're soaking up everything you can learn about this industry. You're learning. You're also learning from Nealon at the time. I understand that other things start to take root at this time. You want to just share a little bit about that?
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, now reaching out, I'm learning a little bit more. Now I'm realizing that the path to get to finance is going to be through an MBA. And so I'm realizing, well, now I need to, you know, prep for that. But one interesting note, during that 60 days, I actually met Mike Milken. He was, you know, of course, he's one of Nealon's friends. And so I was able to, you know, connect with him. And then, you know, pretty, you know, insane now that I'm known in the Milken Institute Young Leader Circle, which I thought was, you know, pretty interesting full circle piece. But then the plans, the seeds are planted that, hey, Reardon is, you know, the Reardon MLT, Management Leadership for Tomorrow, are resources to help underserved minorities break into, you know, top business schools. And so I learned that Reardon had a program where you can do when you're, you know, 3+ years out from applying. And I just like, hey, let me throw my hat in the ring, see what happens. And was fortunate enough to be accepted. And it's been a great program to be a part of, an institution, more more so to be a part of. And MLT, same thing. You know, that's more for like the year before, the year prior, and it's more of an admissions consultancy that review your applications. But, you know, that was one of the most influential, you know, fellowships that I've had. And then after that, there's one more called TWIGO, who helps underrepresented minorities break into finance. And as I've just grown in that organization, I mean, it is just a powerhouse. And, you know, I've gotten a lot closer with Miss TWIGO. I mean, she is just an incredible, incredible human being. So, I mean, it's just like those seeds all got planted during those 60 days because like, hey, now I got to get to business school. How do I get there? Oh, it's through these programs. And through these programs, I kind of learned along the way.
Yeah, the snowball starts to build. And you mentioned Reardon, MLT, TWIGO. In hindsight, what do you feel was the biggest thing that you were not aware of that those programs really helped you with?
I didn't have a network that was, you know, professionally geared towards things that weren't the military. Now I don't have to find people on LinkedIn that would respond to me to then talk to me about banking. Now I'm in these fellowships where we're like-minded, want to do the same things, and they've come from industry. So now I can just ask them, like, hey, you know, what is this? But it also created a cohort of people that I found very interesting that, you know, were different walks of life that I had been associated with. And it just became this great melting pot, honestly. You talk about Reardon, and it's mainly based in LA. You know, then I was able to build a network in LA, you know, going through that. MLT is, you know, across the country, but I will say that is probably the most powerful network that I've built is through MLT, because some very high percentage of all underrepresented minorities that are in top business school programs go through MLT. It's north of 60%. It's a very, you know, strong network. And that's probably the thing that I got the most out of. And I do have to give a shout out to Coach Candace, who was my missions coach during MLT. I mean, and she turned into more of a life coach, to be completely honest. I mean, she was just an incredible person to work with, just so empathetic, had seen a lot of these stories. She was a ADCOM at Haas. And now she worked in MLT doing the impact work there. I mean, it was just so great to, you know, be in contact with her. Like, I mean, I still am in contact with her to this day. Like, I ask her, like, hey, what do you think about this? What should I do here to kind of help someone? And I, you know, take it from there. So I will say you just make those lifelong connections through all of those institutions.
The network, the cohort, the coaching, and it's, like you said, it's come full circle because you serve as a mentor in MLT, so giving back and further building the ability of that group to serve people. We've mentioned a couple of these big groups. I also want to call out, you've also created a group that helped, in particular, Air Force vets, if I understand correctly. I think you call it the club, or at least that's how you referred to it. Share more about this, because this is something you actually have created, and it's had fantastic impact as well.
Yeah, no, Michael. I mean, that's probably the thing I'm most proud of today. It has just been, you know, just a labor of love, you know, building that out. And it has just been phenomenal. And just to kind of give you some context there, I mean, there's this conference called the Diversity MBA Admission Conference. And I thought I was the only person of my, you know, my friend group that was thinking about doing MBA. But an older graduate, you know, he's 4 years older than me, it's like, hey, you should probably come to this. I'm in LA and I think I'm going to go to it. And, you know, I flew out and to my surprise, it was 8 other Air Force Academy graduates there. And before that, I probably knew one person who was maybe interested in an MBA. And so the 8 of us there, we kind of just thinking like, hey, we should probably pull resources together. We shouldn't be doing this alone. And so we created our infamous group chat, our group me, and, you know, and just kind of went from there. It turned into like, you know, we were sharing memes, you know, funny things about V-School. And then it turned into just a cohort interest and accountability. And so we generally then created like, hey, you know, we're going to create a process where that makes it easier for everyone that wants to come from the Air Force Academy and they want to go to business school. You know, we have the process. And then it was just a group of friends. So it wasn't, we weren't trying to be exclusive or anything, but it was just, you know, it was our friend group. And so what ended up happening is like, I kind of took the charge. I was like, hey, I'm going to create this process. You know, I'm going through this right now. And so I'm going to create this process and then let's try it. And so I called it the stratagem. And so essentially what we did, you know, we had the first 2 people who went to B school right when we first started the club, and they went to Wharton and Columbia Business School. And so then I was like, hey, let's take some of the things that they did. I'm going to add some of my thoughts, and we're going to take some other people's things and things that I've gotten from other people I've talked to. And we created this strategy and this process where from, you know, the time you graduate, here are the things you have to do to then ultimately end up in business school. And this runs the gamut. I mean, it isn't just like a, hey, here's the, I mean, we do have like, here's the resources here, how you study for the GMAT. Here's who you speak to. And then we talk to like the other resources we were using. But the important thing is too, we were very adamant about, you know, one of the Air Force's core values is excellence in all we do. Even though we're eventually going to go to business school, we're going to separate from the service. I mean, that did not deter anyone, you know, from being the best officer that they could be in their job in the military. I mean, it was like you had to be, you know, then we get what's called stratifications, where in your paperwork every year you're ranked against your peers. And it was like, you know, it was the norm where you had to be number one. I mean, it didn't matter what was going on. It was like, that was the standard that we, you know, upheld, and then kind of following that core value from the Air Force. And so we had strategies for that, even though, you know, funny enough, all of us were in similar career fields in the military. We did have one pilot. And so it was just like strategies that we came together like, hey, here's from, you know, in the end, how you, you know, effectively get to business school. And, you know, I think the great thing about it is it ended up being very successful. We're 100% effective right now. It's been a great run. And we started about 8 people and we're up to almost 30 now. We've gone from everywhere. I think the first cohort, like I said, was Wharton, Columbia Business School. Second cohort was 2 at Wharton. The third was Harvard Business School and Harvard Law School. And then, you know, the next cohort was Stanford, Harvard, Wharton, and Duke. And then it just snowballed. I mean, it's just been a phenomenal resource now, and just happy to, you know, give back to so many of the people that, you know, that poured into me. And now we're going to try to open it up to more of the academy and ultimately try to, you know, make it a resource for vets. But we built it out and it's been so effective. And then that's just the business school piece. And we were shooting. We didn't know what we were doing. We just kind of just shooting for the moon. And we were fortunate enough to, you know, end up at the schools we ended up at. And we kind of got there and was like, well, if we already shot for the moon, let's try again. And so, and most of us wanted to do finance or something finance related. And we were like, hey, let's just try it. And then we were like, hey, let's build up a strategy, how we can break into finance. And so that also ended up us, you know, there's 4 people who have worked at Goldman Sachs, ironically now, from the group. There's 3 people who are broken into private equity, VC, you know, management consulting. And then I have to give one shout out to Wale Lawal, who probably has the hottest startup in my MBA year. I mean, just closed the $4.5 million seed round for Mesa Quantum. I mean, it's just been incredible run for us. We still don't really understand, you know, like how this, you know, took off so much, but it's been fun. And then now that we're more removed from those processes, you know, you talk about the Reardons of the world, the MLTs. You know, we were originally going through it. You know, it was a stressful time applying and not knowing that we're going to get in. And so now we've built up, you know, cachet within these institutions now. I mean, we talk about the Reardon, you know, fellowship. So at the end of the fellowship, they give an award to the top fellow. I was fortunate enough to win it that year. And so because of that, they then asked me, hey, do you want to be on the alumni board? And so I was like, sure, that sounds like a great opportunity. Lo and behold, they then put me on the board for the Diversity MBA Admissions Conference. And then we ended up running that conference 3 years in a row. And this is the same conference the 8 of us met at. And so it turns into full circle like that. And then, you know, the last year running it, 4 of those 8 people were on the board running the conference. I mean, it's things like that we tried to do in each institution we went in. And that helped with us giving recommendations. MLT, same thing. Once a few of us get through, now we have, you know, there's nicknames like, you know, where are these guys from the club? Where's the Air Force, you know, who's the Air Force crew coming through this year? And it just became, I'm a known quantum. We were a known quantity throughout these fellowships and programs that, you know, kind of bolted us through the MBA application process. So it was like I said, it's been an incredible run and just an absolute passion project, you know, of mine and the whole group as we've built that out.
Well, it sounds like that passion project will continue and expand. And it does, to be clear. So you have to be an Air Force grad to be part of that, right? That at least now the way it exists.
Yeah. I mean, it's very tailored towards the Air Force. So, but you know, I happily, you know, will branch out. I mean, that's kind of my thing too. If anyone from the Air Force Academy reaches out, I generally try to connect with them. You know, same with MLT, same with Reardon, you know, same with Twigo. So it's kind of, and we all have made the commitment to sort of do that as well. And that's another piece of, I think, why we've been, you know, super successful, kind of alluding to the power piece of it. I mean, it's kind of twofold. We make it a priority to talk to other people, whether it's in the military or outside the military now, because one, we think like giving back to those people are, you know, the right thing to do. And I think generally it's one of the things that gives me the most joy was when I've, been in the trenches with someone on version 17 of their essay, and then they get into their dream business school. That, you know, that's just as good as getting the deal done to me as far as, you know, how I feel. And then on the back end of it, it actually, you know, once again, we didn't realize this, but it has become even, you know, valuable for us. And so, like, you know, one of the things that happened, someone reached out to me on LinkedIn, you know, I spoke to him and we kept in touch. Come to find out, you know, later down the line, he said, "Hey, David, I know you were interested in investing, you know, angel investing. I actually have this deal." And so now we're getting, you know, so things like that happen. So it's become this virtuous circle that, you know, yeah. That just, we want to help continue and help build out the network that way as well.
Yeah, that virtuous circle. You mentioned being humble and hungry. I think that's the title of this episode. You are remarkably humble. There's, you know, Division I football, Air Force Academy, Stanford, and you work for the top management firms in the investment world. How do you stay centered here? I mean, there's lots of studies here, right? As you get power, things go to your head. You become less humble. You get disconnected. Is there anything you feel like you kind of deliberately do to keep yourself grounded and humble?
I will say, The people that can humble you the most are football coaches. And I say that with the,
you know. Say more about that.
Yeah. I say there's probably three sayings that, you know, I've learned through football that really just, you know, hits on what your point you're making. I mean, one, it's, you know, the first one is, it's never as bad as it seems. It's never as good as it seems. It's somewhere in between. And I mean, that was just something I learned early on. You know, I thought I had a great game. You know, I made the game-winning play. And what was happening, we watched film the next day of the game, and like you'd be graded. And so, I'm feeling really good. I'm like, hey, I made the game winning play. Come to find out, the only reason why the game was close is because I had messed up two plays before. And so when you thought, you're like, hey, you're on this high road and you're feeling yourself, but no, you actually were, you know, level, you know. And then another time when we lost the game and I thought I didn't make enough plays, and there was a play I thought I could have made that would have won us the game, we turned on the film, and it was like, Dave, this is probably your best game you've had so far. It's like, the only reason it was close is because how well you played. And so it's like kind of those things where like I said, it's never as bad as seeing. That keeps you kind of level just to understand, like, hey, I got to go in with, you know, an open mind to understand what exactly is going on. The second one, and this both came from my high school coach, who is now the head coach of Texas Tech right now, off to a great start. He said, you get 24 hours. And literally because 24 hours is, like I said, we watch film the next day. But what he meant was, no matter what happened, you know, if you broke the, you know, record for sacks, the game, you get 24 hours to celebrate that and feel, you know, feel high off of it. But then after that 24 hours, it's back to work. It's back to go get another win. And the same thing with the loss, you know, lick your wounds, you know, feel bad for yourself for 24 hours, then you got to move on. And so I really take that to heart. Where there's any wins or losses, you kind of, you know, you can sit in it for those 24 hours and kind of go, you know, then you got to move on and keep going. And so that's kind of something I really took to heart. And the last one I got at the Air Force Academy from Tim Cross, who's the D-line coach at UNC right now. You know, he was a walking quote machine. But I mean, one of the things that he really preached that I tell people all the time is, you know, as you get college, it's more, you know, it's more intense. You think you should be getting a lot more playing time sometimes, and people get upset, and people were coming to him and talking to him like, hey, I deserve to play more. I deserve to be starting, you know, whether it was. And so he sat us down. He said, hey, let's get one thing straight. And he told us, he's like, hey, no one gets what they deserve, because if you got what you deserve, you would either be in jail or dead. You know, if you think about everything that you've done. And then he said, no one gets what they deserve. You get what you earn. And so that really was super instrumental in me just thinking, like, I mean, there's nothing that's going to be given. I'm going to have to go out and get it no matter what happens. Like, it doesn't matter what I did the day before. I got to go earn it the next day. And so that was just something that those three things constantly are in rotation in my mind and in my head. And I'm just super thankful for the humbling from my previous football coaches. And then one last bonus one is my girlfriend. She, you know, she works in the healthcare field. And I am constantly just trying to at least make some impact on the level she has. I mean, she's actually saving lives. And so I'm just trying to keep up with her. So she definitely keeps me humble from that perspective.
Yes. And I mean, so much massive insight from coaches, from the world of coaching.
Always.
The part here I would add to the being humble, which was interesting on a previous episode, I had a U.S. Navy, former mission commander, Tennille Cromwell, who was a pilot. And she reflected on also the importance of having a co-pilot, someone who can challenge you and hold you honest at times, important in the cockpit so the pilot doesn't lose focus, or if they're doing something that would be off, co-pilot can speak up. All these memorable quotes, David, and the thing that you said earlier really struck with me about the importance of being memorable, right? That people will remember you in some way. This would seem to lend itself very well to the age of social media, right? Instagram, TikToks, and so forth. But you don't have a massive social media presence. I mean, I sometimes wonder how anyone can when they're as busy as professional like yourself. You're obviously younger than me, so you're more of the social media age. Yeah. You don't have a strong presence. Is that a conscious choice?
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting. I mean, we're, you know, the first generation to grow up with social media. And it was always interesting. The people that I really admired and, you know, wanted to emulate didn't really have those huge social media followings. And then it was probably stamped and approved this thought process when I met Neyland, as a lot of things that I've talked about before. I mean, it was just like when I saw, like, hey, you don't need to have that. It may be, detrimental in the long run. And so I have a LinkedIn. Obviously, I'm very active there. But other than that, yeah, I don't really have much. And I kind of follow the Neyland model from that.
I'm sure that lots of individuals who have benefited from your mentorship or the investing that you do will eventually be sharing you out. And that's the best kind of promotion and presence that one can have, others talking about your brand. David, as we come to the end here, it's been awesome. I wanted to ask you if I could do like a quick lightning round of a couple questions and then we'll wrap it up.
Let's do it.
All right. So these are just meant to be short. We don't need to overthink them. First question, I mentioned at the outset, Division I football, also being a squadron commander. Key learning from that?
Being an empathetic leader. I mean, I think empathy, that's the beginning of everything and any interaction you have. So that was, very evident during those years, very formative, in those formative years. So yep, being an empathetic leader.
Yeah. Biggest inspiration?
Oh, my mother. I mean, by far, just seeing her dedication to, uplifting and growing the next generation and even the people that were struggling. I mean, just seeing how the amount of work she put into it, by far, my mother.
Number three, I've heard you mention some books before. They're all business books. Top non-business book that you'd recommend?
A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, a curveball. It just gives you so much context to the world around you and the kind of the level of physics that aren't touched that, in the schooling you have, like such as quarks, is actually the building blocks of life, not atoms. But, either way, it's a very interesting read.
Four or five, top place you haven't been to yet that you want to go to?
Ooh, Ghana for sure. During business school, there was a trip and I actually couldn't make it. And then it turned out to be the best trip of the entire 2 years. So I want to relive that at some point.
All right. Got to get you on that one. And the last one is another thing we share in common. I heard you like to cook.
Oh yeah.
Right. Kind of humble, but on our previous podcast, not that humble about your cooking, but what's one dish that you don't know how to make that you would love to learn?
Oh, top tier nigiri. Like if I could cook, if I could do that, I would not leave my house. I would never buy any food. But, it takes decades to become a great chef, sushi chef. So probably won't be hitting those marks.
Yeah, they spend a year learning how to just make the rice before they're allowed to touch anything else. Any final question here that I didn't ask that you want to just end us on and answer?
Yeah, no, I think the one that, really that I always enjoy is just a little bit about my family, and I love them. And there's this internal rivalry between OU and Texas in light of the game this weekend. Mm-hmm. So my sister and my girlfriend both went to UT and are diehard Longhorn fans, but my brother played football at OU. And so, the story, the question of like, which one do you root for, given that, set of circumstances? And sorry, but I have to go with OU. He actually, he played football. So I'm a big OU fan. Go Boomer Sooner this weekend.
Love it. Love it. Love it. David, thank you so much. I've got in the show notes, previous areas that you have been quoted in, articles, podcasts, as well as your LinkedIn. But how do people connect to you or have kind of the next software that startup they need investment in? What is the best way people connect with you?
Like I mentioned, LinkedIn is the best way. I'm very active there. We'll, try to respond and, jump on a call with most people if time permits. I'd love to. And then if you're around in Austin, Texas, that's about it.
David Harris, he is here to serve, software investor at Vista Equity Partners. David, absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
No, thank you, Michael. It's been an honor.
Thanks for listening to 97% Effective, where we skip happy talk and help you break through and ascend one hard truth at a time. Help others discover this show. Leave a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, you can get free resources, including the first chapters of Michael's book, Get Promoted, on his website, www.changwinderoth.com. That's www.changwenderoth.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. And now I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.